welcome to another edition of Turned Out of Punk. I'm your host, Damien Abraham, and once again, I am bringing you a conversation with someone who grew up listening to punk, may or may not still be involved in punk, but had their life changed by the genre in a major way. And today on the show, as I tell them, the type of guest you make a podcast like this for, Stephen McBean of the band Pink Mountaintops, of Black Mountain, of Obliterations, of Jerk Ward. More on that in a second, but first, if you want to get in touch with me, head over to DamienAbraham.com. There's an email address there. You can also go over to Facebook.com and you can like the Turned Out of Punk Facebook page, write a comment, send a message. It's run by my brother, Tristan Abraham. He'll get the message to me. You can also go over to various forms of social media like Snapchat and Instagram and Twitter and follow me at Left for Damien and get updates about this show and about other stuff. You can also check out the band I play in, Fucked Up. If you go to fuckedup.cc, we've got some shows coming up. We're gonna be playing with the Descendants. Yep. We're going to be playing with the Misfits. Yep. And it's 2016. Yep. What a life, you know? Like, I never thought I'd get to say that in my lifetime, and here I'm getting to say it now. Anyway, more on that in the future, I'm sure, and hopefully some interviews will come out of that. No even hints at a Misfits thing, because believe me, that I think is an improbability. But maybe the Descendants. We got some time with the Descendants. But anyway, more on that if you follow me on various forms of social media. You can also do me a favor and go over and subscribe to this podcast on iTunes if you're an iTunes user. And if you are an iTunes user, please rate and review this thing. Subscribe to it. Tell your friends about it. Even if you don't use iTunes, tell your friends about it. But if you do use iTunes, you will be kept abreast about the other adjacent podcast to this, Turned Out of Punk Footnotes, which is done by myself and my good friend, and your good friend, Chris O'Toole, where each week we dissect a Turned Out of Punk episode. And my gosh, we're going to have some great stuff to get into this week. Woo! It's going to be a juicy one. But that one tends to drop kind of sporadically, so if you want to find out when it's going to drop, subscribe to it on iTunes. And if not, just, you know, keep checking back. It will come out. We do that every week, normally around Monday or Tuesday. You can also, if you want to support me, go over to vice.com, check out the stuff that I'm doing over there, some articles I'm doing, all sorts of stuff, not just cannabis stuff now, all sorts of other articles too. So go check that out, videos, whatnot. Okay, on to today's show. Today on the show, Steve McBean from all those amazing bands that I said, Pink Mountaintops, Black Mountain, Obliterations, also played in Jerk Ward, a hardcore band back in the day, like at the inception of kind of I guess fast, super fast hardcore in Victoria, which is one of the hotbeds for it, of course, being the home of the Neos. Jerk Ward is a much more obscure band, but awesome. Awesome. There's a record that was reissued a couple years ago. It's extremely limited, so hard to find. But if you do get your hands on it, check it out. I think it's kind of telling that today I was talking to Jonah from Fucked Up, who knows way more about punk and hardcore than I do. And I was telling him about Steve being on the show, and he's like, oh, that's cool, you know, from the Obliterations and everything. And I'm like, yeah, and also Jerk Ward. And Jonah was like, he was in Jerk Ward. So if I can tell Jonah from Fucked Up that Steve McBean from Black Mountain, Pink Mountaintops, Obliterations is also the same Steve from the Jerk Ward tape, which has been circulating for years, then my work is done. Everyone, this is a good one. This has got some deep, deep knowledge about an area that I am fascinated by, which is Victoria. And, oh, it's a good one. There's a lot of great bands brought up. Oh, I love this episode. Okay, so I'm not going to waste any of your time. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy Stephen McBean on Turned Out of Punk.
Certain things for hours and other things I got nothing to say about, but this seems like something I could ramble on about for quite some time.
Well, I am in luck then, because as anyone that listens to this show knows, I very much enjoy rambling on about the topic that we're going to get into in a second, but I'm not going to ramble on. I want you to ramble on first, which is, how did you get into punk? Do you remember the first time you ever came across the genre?
Yeah, I remember there was a McLean's magazine that had a, I'm not sure if it had like a leather jacket with a bunch of pins on it or something, but it I assume this would have been 79 or something, but it had like it had an article on like a, well, it probably would have been like Teenage Head and the Diode.
It's got a Vile Tones thing too.
Yeah,
right? Isn't it a big Vile Tones photo? I think, if I remember correctly.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I was living in Kleinburg, Ontario then with my parents, and I guess I was about 7 or 8. Yeah, and I was in Kleinburg, and we went out to Coquitlam, Vancouver, to a family vacation to my Auntie Joanne's house, and we went to the P&E, and I bought a copy of, it was Road to Ruin by the Ramones, and it was Give Them Enough Rope by the Clash. And then I believe my cousin Gordy also gave me a copy of Disco Sucks by DOA. And that was kind of, that was the start. Like, I had been kind of a music fanatic before that with, you know, Kiss, Bay City Rollers. Then that led into the Cars. And I remember, you know, The Wall and stuff. ABBA was in there and some... I had a friend down the street in Kleinburg that was maybe he was like 15. And he kind of had his, he was into records and stuff, so he'd invite me over and we'd just listen to records, even though I was much younger than him. But I remember him being like, there's this thing called New Wave and, you know, punk and stuff. And yeah, we checked it out. And I kind of became, as soon as I saw, like, I think, like, Sid Vicious or Randy Rampage or pictures of any of those people, it was just like,
hooked.
That was, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, like, Kiss and all of them were cool looking, but the Ramones and stuff were like, I think I remember seeing, like, Suzy Quatro was, like, on Happy Days or something, too. I might have the years mixed up, but it was all around then. And then I guess so I had those records, and the, I guess the big thing was then we moved in 1980 to Sydney, BC, which is like just by the ferries on Vancouver Island by Victoria. And for Halloween, I was like dressed up as a punk rocker, and there's this other kid named Randy Long who was dressed up as a punk, and we were like, hey, into punk too. Like, right on. But his brother, older brother Ricky, a few years older, he had some records. He had like Sid Sings, and I believe he had like, you know, maybe Something Better Change or something. I started going over to Randy and Rick's house after school and listening to more records. But that was kind of the start of, I guess it would be discovering hardcore, or yeah, what the hardcore scene became. Because before, it was still, you know, it was still, even though DOA was just across the water, they still seemed as, you know, as larger than life, you know, the Clash or the Sex Pistols. It was still that thing where you're like, whoa. But then it was like, remember, I think the big changing point was me and Randy and my friend John London. We went down to, I think it was Mesro's Records, and there was the Neo's End All Discrimination 7-inch, and I guess it had, maybe it had been out for 6 months or whatever, but we bought it, and we were like, I guess a good term would be flabbergasted. that you know, of just that they were so young, and they were, you know, playing through, like, you know, cheap guitars and all this stuff. And we put it on, and it was, I believe the first song is it Illiterates?
Yeah, it is Illiterates. Yeah.
So it's like that, and we're just like, whoa, this is like, we're like, this is, well, this, like, you know, this is another game changer, if you will. Mm-hmm. But we were just like fixated with that. And then we started, the three of us, John London and Randy Long and myself, started a band, you know, called Jerk Ward, when I guess we were, we were 11 or 12. It was like kind of just shifted our gears and we were made like, oh, you know, we can do this too. And kind of the whole do it yourself thing. And like, I mean, we didn't know how to play or anything. It was just, I had a guitar and Randy had the bass and John and his mom and myself went over to Drums Only in Vancouver and bought like a 4-piece drum set, and he couldn't afford cymbals. So I think for the first year, he just had the toms and the snare and the kick. And yeah, I think we brought it back. It was tiny. We brought it back on like the bus, or maybe we got it shipped, but there was that. And then there was Youth Plague fanzine. We discovered then, which is from Victoria.
So when did you meet the Neos? Did you, after you got the single, did you mm-hmm. like go out and try and meet these people, or did you just kind of like go back and kind of go and be like, okay, this is out there?
Well, it's, we knew about them, and then we would see like, once in a while you'd see like older, like, you know, punkers walking around, but there was Lyle's Place Records, which is still there. And I think it was me and John, and we went in there, and then we looked over like at the punk section, and all three Neos were standing there like, going through the records. So, I mean, we were, you know, I guess we would have been 13. I don't know, 12 or 13. And we were like, hey, you're the Neos. And they're like, yeah. I mean, I guess they would have been 16 or 18 around then.
Yeah.
And they were, and then we kind of just invited ourselves and we followed them around town, and they were basically doing like the photocopying for Hazabog. It's the Martian Brain Squeeze.
Oh, that's awesome.
And then I remember like John was like, I gotta go home. So he caught the Pat Bay bus back to Sydney. And I was just like, screw it. And because they were jamming, and I basically just invited myself to their jam in Steve Bailey's basement. And, you know, it was Mario's basement. It was called the Sweat Box. It was one of their bedrooms, and it's like they turned on all the heat in the room, and just the room just exploded. And I was just like, whoa, just sitting there. And then they stopped, and I figured out how to catch a bus back to Sydney. And but then they were really they were super supportive. I mean, because then Steve Bailey had a 4-track, and he was like, "Oh, well, we'll come out and we'll record your band." So like him and Kev, maybe even Mario, the first time, packed up his gear and some mics, and they came out to Sydney, John's basement, and basically we ran through our set, and they recorded that. Before that, we had like a. We had a tape up in Lyle's place that was, if you mail us a blank cassette, we'll basically like record you a rehearsal of our jam.
Send you the practice.
Yeah, it was into this like mono, you know, ghetto blaster where we didn't have a PA or anything, so we just kind of screamed right into the ghetto blaster. I think we only made one tape, but Scott Henderson had it, and it was. It was one of those weird things where it's because, you know, we were just little kids, but it was, you know, so raw and primitive and alien sound. It was kind of glorious. Like, I was like, I couldn't believe how, I don't know, it seemed like something that, you know, like, it sounded like, you know, like a Japanese noise band by accident or something that was on, like, a Boredom's record or something, but.
Well, that's the thing about that I love so much about that Victoria scene that, you know, obviously Neo's just before you guys and that you're a part. It's just like, and also on the other side of the, you know, the continent, kind of, you have Deep Wound doing similar mm-hmm. types of things and Siege, but you have these bands that are pushing it to that sonic extreme that death metal would kind of try and push it to a little bit later and grind a little bit later after. But like these bands, you guys were doing it so early, and it's just so unlike the stuff. Like, you know, you're talking about picking up Clash records, and it's like Jerkward is light years away from the Clash as far as pushing that kind of like, yeah, sonic Japanese style attack.
Well, I mean, it's just all those bands, and yeah, I mean, like I remember we ordered the Deep Wound 7-inch, and then it was like, yes, Steve from the Neos, he introduced us to Terabeat Cadet, mm-hmm, like mm-hmm. those bands, all the Finnish stuff, you know, and then of course like the Rudimentary Penai 7-inches and stuff, and I think it was just all these kids that were, you know, a little more suburban. And, you know, not cool. There was no, like, kind of, I guess in bigger cities, you know, like scenes, like the CBGBs, there's kind of like an art scene around it, or, you know, poetry, or all these different, you know, fashion, or all these, or, you know, of course, drugs and all that stuff. But it's like, we were, and I think the Neos too, but like, it was like, it's like, I didn't care about art or anything. It's like, we just cared. We wanted, at that time to be like, pretty much the fastest band, which the Neos did too, and I'm sure Deep Wound the same kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But like, wasn't it, yeah, it's kind of gang, you know, all the Boston stuff. Just it's I don't know what it is.
It's also like you guys were also the templates for what became the hardcore kid. You know, like the idea of this sort of like, even when they're, you know, in an urban setting, slightly suburban kid, mm-hmm, that, you know, doesn't necessarily care about other sides of, you know, punk culture, but like loves the music and is also aware of all this music all over the world that's like this, like the fact that you guys were aware of Terabeat Cadet, and like, you know, you talked to mm-hmm. Jay and Lou, and those guys were definitely aware of like international hardcore, be it Italian or yeah, Finnish or whatever. So there is kind of like that sort of, you guys are kind of laying the foundation for the path that I would one day later walk as a kid who was obsessed with Finnish hardcore living in North America.
Yeah, it's weird. I mean, yeah, like we didn't dress punk or look punk or, but you know, like I had a fanzine called Verbal Assault, and only did 2 issues of that, but it was like,
what was in your fanzine? Like, who do you interview bands for it or?
Yeah. I mean, the first issue was like Negative Approach. I think America's Hardcore was on the cover of that.
Oh my God. What? How did you get a like, photo of America? Like, were you trading photos with people down in the States or something?
Yeah, I had like a pen pal, Bessie Oakley from Reno. She was one of my first, and she did Paranoia fanzine.
Okay.
But a lot of it came through Tim Crow from Youth Plague fanzine. Mm-hmm. So like, but it was all just, you know, like mail order. I mean, not mail order, just, you know, through the mail interviews, and it was like with the Necros, and I did one with Crucifix and Tesco V, and
that's like awesome.
The third one, I think I interviewed Laja from Terabeat Cadet, but that never came out, but
do you still have the transcripts of the tapes at least?
No. Well, it's hilarious. Like, I look back at certain things and been terrible at archiving things. I remember having like a, well, I had the, I remember I had a, it was, I guess it was a flyer for Minor Threat, maybe the McDonald's and something else at the Freezer or something in Detroit. And it had John Brannon's interview that he had written on the back. And I remember being like, I don't know, 17, and going through my stuff and being like, eh, I don't need this anymore. Why would I want this?
Yeah.
You know, but.
Yeah, but the last thing is, sorry.
But yeah, it's just like, you don't, like that whole thing about, none of us, you know, no one was thinking in those terms then. You were just kind of doing it, and it was very exciting, and it was just there and now, and it's even like when a few years later when like me and my friends discovered like Dinosaur Jr. like through skateboarding and Santa Cruz videos, and then, you know, like living all over you and Bug. Like, it was literally, I think, till like maybe like 90 or 91 where I actually put the connection and was like, whoa, those dudes were in deep wound. You know, because there, you know, there's obviously no internet and no, like,
of course, yeah.
You know, you're just like, what?
And it's not like they're hyping that up on the press releases, like featuring members of Deep Wound.
Yeah, so I don't know. They're cool.
No, I just want to like go back, like, you know, America's Hardcore to me, and that's a band that comes up on this podcast a lot because I find them so fascinating because they're one of the great lost bands. Like, I've heard a friend of mine, like, I've got a comp track or two here. Mm-hmm. And then a friend of mine had a tape with an unreleased song on it that I heard one time. But like, what was it about that band that drew you to them? Was it just the cool photo?
It was probably the cool photo, but it was also at the time. I remember they were like one of those bands that like you read about. And I remember like same as like when I bought like a Flex Your Head, it was like we had heard about this band Minor Threat. Like, we'd read about them and, you know, seen a picture in Maximum Rock and Roll and seen reports and this shaved head dude and, you know, I mean, we didn't drink or drugs or any of that because we were, you know, 12, 13, but, but we had heard about them. And it's like when Stand Up came on, it was like, you know, I think we were probably expecting like, you know, like Discharge or something, but it was like, like this kind of weird Kermit the Frog voice. And it just sounded so new and fret. I mean, that whole comp just like, the void, like everything was just like, wow.
Yeah.
And like, it's like I don't know how many bands are on that comp, like 15 or whatever. And like, they all sound completely different. But I mean, I think America's Hardcore was that at that time, you know, of 7 Seconds and like the scene and like the kind of new, like, of course, like SSD Control, but mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, like, probably nowadays you'd be like, oh, you know, you saw a band called Canadians Hardcore, you'd be like, oh, it's kind of a bad name. maybe, I don't know. But like at the time, it was this like, whoa, like, that's powerful. You know, like,
Yeah, I know. Have you ever seen that movie Made, the Vince Vaughn, John Favreau thing from like mid-2000s?
I don't know.
There's a scene in it in the opening, and Vince Vaughn is wearing an America's Hardcore shirt.
Oh, really?
Yeah, like they're driving. And if you listen to the audio commentary track on the DVD, he's like, oh, yeah, this is like a local punk band. And I guess the guy from America's Hardcore is a costume person in Hollywood now.
Yeah, he actually recently died. Oh. He was the guy that was also in Crucifix briefly. Yeah. And he's one of the auxiliary characters in Suburbia.
That's right. Okay. That, you know, now it's coming back a little bit. I do remember reading that.
But Drew, yeah. And it was that literally like, I think it was like a year or so ago, but it was that thing where someone, you know, posted a thing on Instagram. It might have even been Southern Lord or something. And then it said America's Hardcore. And I was like, whoa. Because I think the interview was with Danny from the band, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess he took his life, but yeah, he was well loved.
Yeah, absolutely. You know? Well, it's amazing when you get to that, I guess you get to that point now where you're like seeing these people at later stages in their life, and you're like, oh, I knew them when they were like this other world that they were in at one point.
Yeah, it's. We just played in Copenhagen, and my friend Naya, who lives in Copenhagen, and she I can't remember if she's married or dating Rainey from Discharge, but she brought Charlie, the drummer from Anti-Cemix, to the show.
That is awesome.
So I was like, dude from Anti-Cemix is on the guest list. But I loved all the Finnish stuff and the Swedish stuff, like Chaos and...
Yeah, like, where were you getting these records from? Like, the international stuff specifically? Like, were they getting them in as imports, or were you having to mail order it all yourself?
There was some mail order. I did, I went to Disneyland with my parents in, I guess, 82?
Okay.
Maybe it was 83? 82. And I left Disneyland and found a record store and bought, like, I think I was hiding them, but it was, so it was only 7 inches, but I meant it was like the Native Approach 7 inch, Rebel Truth 7 inch, then it was Chaos, Totalina Chaos, and the Bastards, World Burns to Death. And
what store did you go to buy them? Do you remember?
I think it was probably just a tower or something.
Whoa.
It was just I guess it would have been Anaheim, and it was just a big record store. But yeah, what else? There was a couple other ones, like maybe like, what's that? We don't like bananas band from Chicago. Anti-Pac-Man. Negative Element.
Oh,
maybe
okay.
It was them too.
Were they from Chicago or Madison? Chicago, you're right.
Maybe Madison.
No,
yeah.
I mean Chicago, you're right. Wow, what a weird haul. Were you just like these ones, or were these bands that you've been, like, as you said before, like with Minor Threat, been reading about, now you're like, I finally have this record?
I think a few of them, definitely the Finnish stuff, because it was on the propaganda records.
Yeah.
And definitely I'd heard of the Negative Approach was another, like, jaw dropper, like dropping that seven inch on and being like, whoa.
And how many bands were making it out to, were you able to see at that point? Was it mainly local stuff were you seeing, or were there like,
there was local stuff
over?
And I mean, there was DOA, HOC. I mean, you know, Black Flag came a bunch with. So, I mean, the first time, which would have been amazing, it was the Subhumans and Black Flag, and I think Saccharine Trust with Husker Du opening. But I was too young for that. So the first one I saw them was the My War tour, and then it was with.
Still not bad. Not
yeah, and then Meat Puppets on too, and
yeah.
That band, Mugger's band, Nig Heist opened, which was quite.
Oh,
you know.
Yeah. What was that like? What were they at that point? Because I guess they went through different phases as far as live performance goes, but that would have been pretty early, I would guess, for them.
Yeah, I mean, it was. I guess it was them all wearing like. Wigs and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't totally get the joke at the time, but so it was probably like Bill Stevenson on guitar and maybe, like, you know, I don't know, whoever, one of their, was it Tom Tricoli was Flag sound guy or something like that. Like just anyone from the SST crew who was around. But that was,
who were there,
yeah,
a local,
I mean,
was there a local band on that one or just those two?
That was actually No Means No opened that.
And oh,
it was
awesome.
Right when they went from a 2-piece to a 3-piece. So Andy Kerr joined them halfway through.
Did you ever see the Infamous Scientists or were,
no,
that's before, I guess, you moved there even.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was too young for that. Or there was a lot of like cool. A lot of that cool, weird stuff in Vancouver, too. Like, all that kind of Pere-Ubu-influenced stuff. And
mm-hmm.
But
is No Fun? Are they from Vancouver Island, right?
I think No Fun was.
Or No Exit. No Exit is onto it. Sorry.
No Exit. I think No Exit's from. I think they're from Vancouver.
Okay.
They played the first show I ever went to, which was like, this is kind of a sad story.
Okay.
So it's like really red personality crisis.
Oh.
But I had to leave before those bands played. But I think No Exit was like the headliner.
Oh, wow.
But were isn't
they,
that like,
were they popular?
The rarest Canadian? I don't know. It was probably just, I don't think anyone cared, you know, it's like no one cared back then really, you mm-hmm. know, like, but isn't that like supposed to be like the rarest Canadian punk record, the No Exit record?
It would be
for
that
one of them?
Or that or the Gentleman of Horror single.
Yeah.
Which is, they're from Victoria, right?
No, they were from Kelowna.
Kelowna, that, oh fuck, I'm not getting anything right now. Yeah, so yeah. Gentleman of Horror, What were the, did you ever see them or that before?
No, that was another one that I think there was another one. These are all, I think, Youth Plague shows where I could stay for a little bit. So there was one that was, it was Gentlemen of Horror and then like Red Tide and Dayglows, but the Accused was one of the openers. Oh. It was like a very early Accused show.
Was it before Blaine was singing even? Or was
yeah.
Like, whoa.
It was with that John guys from like the same line, I guess, is the split with the Rejectors. The Farts.
Oh.
Or Rejectors, yeah.
Wow, that's awesome. So what was it like at that point? Because like that,
they
love
were
that
awesome.
Record. Yeah. Oh.
Yeah, actually, I think I interviewed them for my, maybe it was the second issue. There's an interview with the Q's, but they were amazing. I mean, they were still, they had that, you know, kind of like that fast thing, like the Neos and all that, but they were also like, you know, in probably into Motorhead and Judas Priest, so it was starting to hit that splatter rock thing, you know. But yeah,
so like I was,
yeah, they were killer.
So like, yeah, like you're at this age. What was your first show that you played with Jerkward?
The first one was it was opening for Scream, and it was September 3rd, 1983.
Oh. So is that still, are they touring on still Screaming with that, or that the second record?
That was still Screaming, yeah.
Oh, that's amazing.
So we had to leave for that too, so I didn't get to see them.
I guess that's the thing. It's like you are super young. Like it's like you're like under 16 at this point. Like were there even clubs where you weren't allowed to be in the club type thing until you played? Or?
I mean, all the shows in Victoria then were basically either at the OAP Hall, mm-hmm, or the Fernwood Community Center. So, I mean, those were just halls that people rented. I think they had a few shows at this place called the Faux, which was, you know, Fraternity of Eagles, which had a bar attached. But
okay,
I think most of the shows, I think the first time I like tried to sneak into a show in Victoria was, I guess it would have been 85. It was because the Asexuals were playing. So I couldn't, that was like the first time I was like, what do you mean? Like, I can't come in. So I remember just watching them through the window, and they're amazing, but.
Yeah. Oh, what a bummer.
Yeah.
I missed that show. So you brought about, you talked about your fanzine, and there's like, obviously, you know, like a bunch of other amazing fanzines and like a fanzine culture, like Bad Attitude. Was that a fanzine from there?
Oh yeah. That was from Cranbrook.
Yeah. I've got an issue with that. And it's also, like, mm-hmm, you said, it's got a Finnish scene report in it as well. Is that all like that taste? Where does that come from in that scene? Cause like, you know, is it from the Neos originally getting you guys into that stuff? Or is it just like, more than any other scene, it seems.
Well, it was like, so there was the Neos, and I'm trying to remember what Kev, Jerkface Kev, had a zine, which I can't remember the name of. But then there was Youth Plague, which was like the big one that Tim Crow did. And then there was in Delta, what was it called? Idle Thoughts, which this guy named Len Morgan did. I think he passed away like maybe 10 years ago. And I had this friend Sue from Delta that did a zine, but they were all kind of that wave of, yeah, of, you know, just post, like, you know, like DOA and Subhumans. It's like the new crew, and like, part of that was just like the Finnish stuff. Mm-hmm. And then I guess the Italian stuff was a little bit afterwards. But
yeah, like Cheetah Chrome motherfuckers and like the power and everything. I guess it's also must be, where would, like, I guess it would be like Maximum Rock and Roll Scene Reports would be a lot of the source of information. And then before you'd start like to get the people's addresses to start writing rated.
Yeah. I mean, I sent like my zines to MRR and like just, by sending, basically they had a thing back then, if you send us your zine, we'll send, so I got like Maximum Rock and Roll like delivered to my house for like, it seemed like 4 years. My parents' house, we were still getting MRRs. But yeah, it was just the scene report, and then you just, you know, write someone. I remember my mom being like, because there was a point where I was getting like tons of mail, and then my friend Bessie, who did Paranoia Fanzine, she was in that band The Rex.
Okay.
All these names are slipping my mind. Who later played in The Dicks.
I was trying to think it was in The Rex.
Yeah. She was actually at those dinosaur shows. And then she was in Sister Double Happiness and my brain. But then she started working for BYO. In LA. So I remember coming home one day and basically like a box of like, and it was like, you know, The Crew and like The Unwanted and Stretch Marks and, I don't know, all those records that kind of came out at the same time. Kind of that weird Canadian, assault on, American punk.
Yeah.
On the prairies.
Yeah. Like, I guess like who would have been that? I've always wondered about that. Like, who is the person that was like, yo, we got to sign this band from Canada, this band from Canada, you know, like there was like The Unwanted, Stretch Marks, SNFU, I guess mainly those three. But then there's also the comp which has like Youth mm-hmm. and all the other Canadian bands on it too. Something to believe in.
It must have been like that Youth Brigade Social Distortion tour, like that Another State of Mind tour, because they played all across the prairies.
And also,
I know the show in Victoria got like shut down by the cops before anyone played.
Oh, wow. But were you at that show, or was that before your time?
No, before my time. I knew of it, but I wasn't getting in.
Yeah, you're like 12, so don't worry. It's funny when you think about BYO too, because like the Stern Brothers are Canadian, right? Like they were born in Toronto before they moved down there.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So maybe it's like they felt like some national pride deep down to the stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, those great, amazing bands.
Oh, absolutely. Awesome bands. Awesome. And speaking of awesome bands, Red Tide. So what's the transition from you playing in Jerk War to Red Tide?
I was just basically like Red Tide was like the other super influential band along with the Neos, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Like their Rundown tape and their Out of My Way tape before that. They had that in a more melodic way, but that same kind of Victoria, like weird alien, you know. But that, I remember I was just, Jerk Ward had broken up, and I think I was just skateboarding around Victoria, and I ran into either Ken or John from Red Tide, and they're like, hey, do you want to play bass? And I was like, okay. I didn't have a bass or anything, but I borrowed Chris's, the previous bass player's bass, and I was only in them for a year. I was on the Final Solution tape, and then we played a bunch of shows, but it was like kind of like, I was kind of bummed because I liked the earlier Red Tide more than the Red Tide that I was in. But even though that stuff now, when it was like John Craig's was like, such a phenomenal songwriter for like his age, like his arrangements and all that. I think that was pretty influential on like, yeah, just like all the stuff that's like, it's maybe not the best recorded or executed, but just the songs there. And I remember being like, what are you listening to? He's like, oh, Bruce Cockburn. I'm like, really? The fuck you listen to that for? But then it was also like, at the end of that, that's when like Mission of Christ started, you know?
So yeah.
It was kind of like The Accused, COC, and because Mission of Christ was basically Jerk Ward with our friend Mike singing. So like, it was like all the same people. And then and then Kev from the Neos joined Mission of Christ because he was in a band with John, our drummer, called Sludge Confrontations.
Okay.
Which was like near the end of the Neos and then a bit after.
Did they record Sludge Confrontation?
Yeah, they have like a bunch of tapes. They even have a flexi that came out on that dude Diggs label, which I guess it was Manic Ears, but then it turned into Earache.
Okay.
From Nottingham, because Kev went and lived in England for a bunch, and then when he came back, we had started Mission of Christ, and I guess he wanted to get Sludge Confrontations going again, but then when he heard us, he was just like, well, I'll just join you guys. We're like, cool.
So did you play on the Red Tide single, or is it after the single that you joined?
It's like right after the Toxic Shock single, yeah.
Yeah, because I was always wondering, like, the Toxic Shock to me is such an interesting label, and I was, like, wondering how that relationship came about, but I guess it would have been, once again, probably through letter writing, I would imagine.
I think letter writing, it was, I guess, kind of like that, the Barricaded Suspects comp,
yeah.
Red Tide was on that.
Oh, that's right, they're on that comp, that's right.
And they're on that, MRR comp, Welcome to 1984.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think the mail was, I'm sure still is, but a very powerful, exciting tool at that time. It was like, I think it was like the, maybe that of just waiting, checking the mailbox and checking it, and then you open it up and like the, you see the 7-inch in there, or the little parcel ticket. You're like, oh, that means there's LPs at the post office. Can you drive me, Mom?
with playing in Red Tide, was Jerk Ward, was it a hard stop, or were you kind of keeping going before it became Mission of Christ?
I guess it kind of just petered out. Like at the very end, we basically we kicked out Randy.
Mm-hmm.
And then we played like one show in Vancouver, and then we played a show in Steve Bailey's basement of the Neos with like the Daglos and No Means No. And then we recorded some stuff, but we never finished it. I remember we played in the Vancouver show. There was a kid there that was a, seems weird to say fan, but he, when we finished playing, he's like, that's not Jerk Ward. Cause we were kind of like, I think by then we were kind of leaning into at least going for like hitting our posse core era with maybe a bit of Battalion of Saints and stuff. So it was, maybe it slowed down a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You weren't doing the blur speeds anymore.
And it didn't have a Randy's, the sandpaper vocals. So. Plus, I guess we were going through puberty, so our voices changed.
Yeah. It's a painful transition that every young teenage band has to make when puberty comes. So with Jerk Ward, like, you kind of did the demo tape and the 7-inch, like, right at the same time? Or do you do the demo tape much before? Or
the silencing? With Jerk Ward?
Yeah, well, not Jerk Ward, Mission of Christ, sorry. Mission of Christ.
Oh, yeah, we just recorded that. That demo, Scott Henderson and Spud from the Daglos recorded it. But yeah, those two songs from the 7-inch are just from those same sessions.
Oh, it's on that. Those two songs are on the tape too.
Yeah,
I never heard the tape. I got to hear this tape one time. It's like a big money tape too. People like it goes for a lot of money these days.
Really,
it's in need of a reissue.
Strange.
I tell you, this is the thing. This is like, little did you think when you were 17, throwing out that John Brandon flyer, that all these years later, a 35-year-old father of three would be asking you about this garbage.
It's kind of true. It's nice, though. It's exciting.
Well, it's also amazing that, like, you know, a bunch of kids had, like, No Effects covers the Neos on one of their 7-inches.
Oh, yeah.
Bands in mm-hmm. Japan, I've seen, you know, reference the Neos or wear Neo shirts and stuff like that. Like, it's just like, it's amazing. Or Daglo Abortions of the, you know, and all the stuff you've done, obviously, in other bands and in music. It's like, it all came out of this, like, one scene of a bunch of teenagers.
The whole touring network and the way of touring that bands tour now was, like, built on that, whether bands know that or not. But before that, it was like, oh, we'll play, you know, San Francisco, New York, Toronto, but then this thing of just building these networks, and especially back then, like, you think, you know, it's like, you know, no internet, all these things, you know, and then we're gonna you know, let's, we're going to press a record and we're going to, you know, like they, it's pretty mind blowing.
Yeah. No, it's like, it really is like the means of production were in the hands of the artists. And in this case, the artists were, you know, 14, 15, like able to make a tape and distribute it, able to make their own like music media. You know, I'm sure there wasn't a lot of like mainstream Victoria music media covering the comings and goings of the Scandinavian punk scenes, you know? So it was like,
no,
up to you guys to kind of do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. It's a very beautiful thing. Getting all misty eyed now.
I think one of the problems is though, that none of the, like, as you say, like it's hard for the bands to tour. Like what was the first point where you kind of like, other than doing the odd Vancouver show, kind of like set out outside of province even to kind of tour?
Not till the early 90s.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, I mean, like Mission of Christ got, like, we got, I think the first label that offered us like a record deal or whatever you call it was Alchemy.
Oh,
you know,
that was awesome.
And yeah. And I remember talking to the guy and he being like, I remember just basically like getting a letter back from Alchemy and then reading it. And like, I think Kev was sitting next to me and I looking at him, I was like, does this mean we, like, are we getting, are we signed? Is he? But then it was like, he was like, you'll come down to San Francisco and you'll record with, I think it was Mark Dutremont, who was like in the guitarist for Clown Alley and stuff. And he recorded
also
all that
stuff.
He
was one of the owners, right? Of the label,
yeah.
Too.
And then so us just being like,
forces you to pay him to record you too. That's what a good scam for a label to have.
But then it was like that thing. Like we were like, I don't know. We're like, how do we get to San Francisco?
Yeah.
Like no idea.
Yeah.
I think that whole MRR, like book your own life thing, that kind of opened the doors for a lot of things. I remember like going to see like, I think it was Suicidal Tendencies at the New York Theater. And it was like, I guess it was Join the Army tour.
Okay.
Standing next to my friend, you know, and it was totally packed. And we were like, it was the first time it ever dawned on our brains. We're like, how much are they getting paid tonight? We're like, you think they're like making like $500? And we're like, that's insane. Can you imagine if you went on tour and made $500 every night? Like, you'd be a millionaire. But you know what I mean? Like having this,
yeah.
Just like,
well, you don't know because you're like, you've never done it.
Yeah. I remember like, I was probably 14 and my zine had come out and some like punk rock lady from, I guess, Seattle had gone to Victoria and bought my zine and she called the number. She's like, hey, Steve there. And I'm like, oh yeah. And she's like, you know, I put out a zine too. And we're talking about music and all these stuff. And then she's like, well, I'm staying at a hotel downtown. If you know, I got some beer and stuff. You want to hang out? And I was like that, I'm 14. Like, just kind of like, just, you know, kind of cute.
So did you go hang?
No.
No.
I'd have been terrified
yeah,
of girls.
Absolutely. Well, no, you're a kid. Yeah. You know, it's funny too, because like, you know, if you guys had signed to Alchemy, what a run that label had with like the Melvins, Neurosis, Poison Idea, and Virulence, which is the pre-Fu Manchu band.
Oh, that's like, right. RKL
and
on there. Yeah,
RKL too, of course. I got to leave out RKL. And Sacrilege BC. So where did you kind of go after, like you mentioned earlier, kind of hitting a transition point of getting into Dinosaur Jr. When did that happen? Or was that happening when you're doing a Mission of Christ? Mission of Christ.
I think that was all, I don't know. I think that was just kind of that whole scene kind of melded with, you know, with like Husker Du kind of being like a thrash band and then, you know, like Metal Circus being like, you know, this cool, like melodic thing. And I think, but I mean, like back then too, it's like, it seemed like anytime like bands made like a big change, you know, like My War or anything like that. It was like, at least me and my friends, it was like, we were all for it. It was like, what are they going to do next? You know? So it's like the thing of the Dinosaur Jr. and listening to this Dinosaur Jr. and then Slayer and COC, like it just kind of all made sense, you know?
Yeah. So you never had that kind of like gimme indie rock Lou Barlow moment that he talks about where it just kind of like you kind of were able to kind of stay involved in everything.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sure, I know that like part of the reason, like at the end that like Mission of Christ broke up was kind of cause it was that scene became so violent and it was like, we'd play in Vancouver and that's when like Blasphemy and all that crew was around. And then there was also like, you know, like the Nazi skins that had ended up in Vancouver and Victoria because they basically got beat up across Canada by like the BFG.
Yep.
But they, I mean, it was like basically like when they came to Victoria, it was that thing like we were all these little kids. So they kind of just like forced hung with you.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I mean, like most of those kids back then, like they weren't like Nazis. They were just like really messed up kids from broken homes, you know? Mm-hmm. And they'd wear some stupid shirts and shit, but.
What like, you mentioned Blasphemy there, which is like, I would say probably even more than America's Hardcore, the most fascinating band in the world to me, as far as just like, you know, like you mentioned, like the culture around this band was pretty extreme. Was it like as over the top as people say? Was it like an open war with the Nazis?
There was some pretty
outlandish stories.
There was some pretty like, I mean, it's hard because it was like, I'm thinking, picturing it in my mind from like, you know, like a 17-year-old to 19-year-old kid, which is about the age I was then. But it was like, there was some shows at the New York Theater. I know we played like a lot with like The Accused and Death Sentence and stuff. And Vancouver, so you know, because of that you get the whole scene of like thrash metal kids, skaters, and then you know kind of like the older Vancouver kind of, you know, junkie punk kind of
the gnarly
whole scene.
Yeah.
But I remember at one point like seeing like basically one side there's like Blasphemy and the fuck, you know, the satanic skinheads. On the other side, there's like the Nazi skins, like Fifi, and I don't know, at the time, I guess Elmo and all those dudes. But it was, yeah. And then seeing some pretty heavy brawls, all the Norwegian black metal went, you know, like white supremacist. Because, you know, Colorado of the Storms is black. They were just all, fuck those dudes. And so I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah.
But it was, I mean, it was, like I say, it was like, it was terrifying in the eyes of my age then. I'm sure it still would be. It was like, you know.
I think it'd be scarier for you now. Like,
some big dudes.
Yeah, like, I think back to my time and stuff I saw as a kid. And I'm like, as an adult, that's way more fucking frightening to me than it was when I was younger witnessing it.
Yeah, we played, Obliterations played this art opening, and it was with Strife and Excel. And it was an art show at this warehouse for, I can't remember his name, but something like Punk Rick or something. He was the one that did all the Welcome to Venice.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Artwork and stuff.
Awesome.
And it was awesome. There's all these photos, and there was like, you know, like these old Latino punks, you know, gangsters that are, you know, some of them probably pushing 55 and stuff. And they're all there and they're looking at the old photos. They're awesome looking. You know what I mean? It's a cool, wicked scene. And then like Excel played and it was like that thing where I'm like, you know, when you're like on the side of the pit and you're like, oh, blah, 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 and then you're like, whoa, like I'm getting the hell out of here.
Yeah.
And like I say, it was an art opening. It wasn't like the Olympic ballroom in 83, but it was like, these dudes are huge. Yeah. And like they're going in. And I was just like, whoa.
Yeah.
It's, I mean, like, it was exciting.
Yeah. But now there's consequences. Like, you know, if you get hurt, yeah, there's pain and recovery.
Yeah. It's true.
Well, I'm not going to keep you that much longer, Stephen, because I have kept you for such a long time. And I want to have you back for a part two, because we are not even going to get a, pretty much of your teenage years, I think, cool, in part one. You know, we're like, we're, yeah, like, I could talk to you forever about all this sort of stuff. I guess like the kind of like the next thing I wanted to move on to, which is like, you know, you mentioned Obliterations, mm-hmm, and were you kind of like always a fan of punk rock, like throughout kind of like that sort of throughout the 90s and into to present day type thing?
Yeah. I mean, like part of like, I guess, you know, it was like, I was like playing in, I guess, punk bands of different sorts, like up till, mm-hmm, I guess I was like 27, and then it was just like that weird thing of like, I was just like, I want to do something different. I didn't know what I mean, like I didn't know what I wanted to do, but it was kind of this almost this searching thing and doing all these different little things. And sometimes certain like situations, like it was like me and Josh did this band Jerk with the Bomb, which, yeah, started out as like, you know, like a 4-track cassette thing that I did, I guess, in like 95. And then it was like, our friend was like, oh, I'll put out a record for you. Then it was like, you know, before that, it was this thing where, you know, we just did it once in a while. Then it was like, oh, well, if, you know, if someone's putting on a record, we'll tour. So it's just like kind of like just the way life goes and different, yeah, things. And it was the same thing with like, and then with like, you know, Jerk with a Bomb basically turning into Black Mountain, you know, getting heavier, but kind of all these different influences. And like, I mean, Obliterations was like, Sam was like, hey, do you want to jam with Austin from Saviors? And we're like, I'm like, yeah, cool. And it was, I think the first jam was like Adam, who was like in Children and stuff. And, I think we went there and like, we all jammed around, you know, just, you know, you smoke a J or whatever and you jam, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I kind of just said, I was like, dudes, I'm already in a rock band. Can we just start a punk band? And everyone was just like, yeah, great idea. And it's kind of like, it's been really fun to play in that band. And it's weird because it's like going back to like when we write, it's like we basically like every song's written in 20 seconds, you know, we're just like, okay, they're done. And then Sam writes the lyrics. And, but it's weird to go back to that. Like Obliterations would be probably pretty close to the band that I wanted to be in when I was 13.
Yeah.
Or 14.
Yeah.
Which is kind of exciting, you know what I mean? Like, you know. But it's weird to like know like the certain tricks. It's, mm-hmm, like, oh, Greg Ginn plays through PA heads, solid state. Like, you know, it's like these weird things of like how you get that kind of Jerry's Kids, like,
yeah. Now you can demystify it. Now you know it's exactly like you're like, what they were doing.
It's like, which is kind of, you know, which is fun, you know?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Maybe not, you know, it's just a different way of approaching it, but it's also good to be like, I mean, just where it's like, it's what it is. It's either, you know, it's either just got to be brutal or not. If it's not brutal, it's not.
Well, it's also like, what
move along.
You know, before, yeah, like, it's like, you know, Pink Mountaintops and Black Mountain, it's like, it's like definitely punk informed, and you can tell how much, you know, punk and hardcore has obviously informed, you know, your sonic outlook and probably more outlook, you know, throughout your life from getting into it at such a young age.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, do you know that kid Fote, like Jeff? You probably know him.
I don't think so. Maybe.
Trying to remember his last name. He's been around forever, tons of bands, but he sent me this message once, and it was like about Pink Mountain Tops outside Love record, and he's like that's the best guitar record other than Hear Nothing, Say Nothing, See Nothing. I was like, what? But he somehow, you know, just like, I guess, got out of like the walls of and layers of guitars and fuzz and whatever. I was like, thank you.
Yeah.
Just like, that's a kind of, you know, a little compliment. That's like a, that's like 10,000 compliments rolled into one.
Yeah, it's amazing. Like, you know, like you said, like, you know, finding out how Greg Ginn got his guitar sound, or Jerry Skids got their sound, or like, you know, or you know, having the, like, the way Discharge does their guitars show up on a Pink Mountaintop record. It's like, you can tell it's had an impact.
Cool.
But like, Stephen, thank you so much, man, for taking the time to talk to me today about all this stuff.
It's my pleasure.
You've helped me put together a lot of pieces to puzzles that I've been agonizing over for years.
Oh yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Cool.
If you want to talk more any other time, I'm good.
Thank you, Stephen. And as you can tell, there's room for more. So he's going to be back here for more parts in the future. But speaking of future, we got to talk about next week. Next week on the show, not one, but two guests. Actually, kind of three. Next week on the show, Nicola and Friedrich from Millencolin will be here. I mean, literally here in my record room hanging out with me. And also my friend Mike Viktorovich was there too, who's Nicola's cousin. And yeah, it is a great episode. There's tons of fun stuff in it, from like the Burning Heart stuff all the way back to like Swedish hardcore stuff. It is a good episode. That is next week on the show. Thank you everyone for listening. Once again, please write me an email. Go over to DamianAbraham.com. Follow this thing on Facebook, Turn Into Punk on Facebook, various forms of social media, @LeffertDamian. And check out what I do on Vice, Damian Abraham. Check out Fucked Up, fuckedup.cc. Subscribe to this. Tell your friends. Just tell your friends. And I'll see you on Footnotes. We're going to have a lot to talk about. So that's going to be a fun episode. And I guess that's it. I will see you next week. Thank you for listening. Go out there and make your own culture. Bye.